This is Free Speech Radio News for Cinco de Mayo, Monday, May 5, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. As the Pentagon finalized their rules for trying the Guantanamo prisoners, the chemical industry lobby opposes a new bill to protect plants from attack. The medical situation in Iraq is critical. And today is Cinco de Mayo, and Chicano communities are hitting back at alcohol and tobacco companies that target the communities on a day of celebration. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. One Israeli official is on his way to D.C., reportedly to ask the Bush administration to support his plan to make Jordan the official Palestinian homeland. Ula Al-Farawati has more from Amman.
4 days after announcing the long-awaited Palestinian-Israeli peace roadmap, Israel's tourism minister Benny Allen flew to the U.S. yesterday with a controversial plan that envisages setting up a Palestinian state in Jordan, which is home to at least 3 million Palestinian refugees. Allen, who is on an official visit to promote tourism to Israel, planned to also meet with congressmen and other government officials and warn them of the dangers of the roadmap to Israel and convince them of the viability of his own plan, which also suggests dismantling the Palestinian National Authority. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon sharply criticized Allen and said his actions would embarrass not only the state of Israel, but also the White House. Jordan's government also criticized the minister's plan, saying it was silly and untimely. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
The Israeli Defense Force continues deporting international peace activists, reportedly after learning that last week's suicide bombers may have been British citizens. Mohammed Ghalani reports from Gaza City.
The harassment continued in the West Bank city of Nablus as Israeli forces stormed a youth community center run by the Medical Relief Committee. The center served as a base for international peace activists in Nablus. Dr. Ghassan Hamdan of the Medical Relief Committee said that the army had blown up the front door and had wreaked havoc in the emergency clinic and the library. The veteran Israeli peace activist, Uri Avineri, stated that the Israeli army wants to be rid of international peace activists because it has something to hide. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Mohammed Ghalayini in Gaza City.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission and an independent contractor hired by the operating Ohio utility all agree there are serious problems with the now-closed nuclear power plant in Toledo. Yet First Energy officials want to open the plant, despite comments by both groups' reports saying they have serious problems with their safety culture. The nuclear power plant was shut down 14 months ago after a football-sized piece of steel liner was eaten away by acid corrosion. Management says the workers don't have what it takes to run a safe facility. The workers say safety concerns are brushed aside in favor of higher profits. Reports by the NRC and the independent contractor say both are partially true and put the plant at risk of a meltdown, leaving residents to cope with the potentially deadly results. Following a national protest in Austin, Texas on Saturday, 50 protesters caravanned to Crawford, where President Bush met earlier in the day with Australian Prime Minister John Howard. Area police were waiting for the caravan and arrested 7 people. Renee Feltz files this report.
After traveling 2 hours from the showdown in Texas protest in Austin, a caravan of roughly 25 cars arrived in Crawford with hopes of holding a festival of life. When they pulled off to the side of the road to unload props, they were met by a line of police. Crawford Police Chief Donnie Tidwell gave a 3-minute warning for the protesters to get back in their cars. The caravan included 6 members of the Austin People's Legal Collective. Member Rose Sherwood explains what happened next.
Everyone started getting back in their cars to try to regroup, and they immediately started grabbing people and arresting them. And that included 3 members of the legal team who were wearing shirts that said they were part of the legal team.
The 7 people arrested were charged with the Class B offense of violating Crawford's parade permit and have since been released. A city ordinance prevents protests in Crawford from taking place anywhere but inside the town's stadium and then only after a permit has been secured. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz.
Thousands of documents related to Joseph McCarthy's 1950s investigation of alleged communists, later called witch hunts, were released today. Jay Tamboli reports from D.C.
The hearings led to the blacklisting of many Americans, and McCarthy called prominent actors such as Orson Welles and Lucille Ball to testify. McCarthy was censured by the Senate as a result of his persecution of citizens for their political views, but Kit Gage, director of the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, worries that today's terrorist investigations show that some people have forgotten the lessons of McCarthyism.
The Bush administration, and especially the Justice Department, has been remarkable in the way that it's expansively gone after people, you know, not because just of any evidence of criminal activity or any violent activity, but trying to stop people precisely because of their politics, precisely because of ethnicity, precisely because of religion.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Jay Tamboli.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
National media focused this weekend on what they saw as a battle between the State Department and the Pentagon over the fate of the more than 600 so-called enemy combatants held at Guantanamo Bay in U.S.-occupied Cuba. As the U.S. works to keep nuclear weapons material from leaving North Korea, Washington may be preparing to restart its own nuclear weapons testing program. And allegations are swelling in Congress of pandering to the gun lobby and payoffs from the chemical industry to the detriment of American safety. Josh Chaffin has the roundup on all these stories from Washington, D.C.
The U.S. still refuses to give the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay prisoner of war status, to the dismay of many foreign governments. The more than 600 alleged Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters, a few of them children as young as 13, are being held on no charge with representation or legal rights. The Pentagon says there have been 25 suicide attempts at the camp. Media reports say Secretary of State Colin Powell and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld are at odds over the prisoners' fate. Powell urging swift action, Rumsfeld asking for more time to interrogate them all. David Danzig with the Lawyers Committee on Human Rights.
There shouldn't be any place on this earth where no laws apply. And unfortunately, the United States has set one up in Guantanamo Bay. And we're pleased that Colin Powell is saying, hey, wait a minute, we've got to apply at least some standards here and try and figure this situation out better than we have so far. Of course, we'd like Colin Powell to pressure the government even further than he has.
The Pentagon has reportedly finalized rules for the military tribunals it'll use to try the Guantanamo prisoners. Plans include a permanent gag order on attorneys who defend the prisoners so that all information about them can be controlled by the Pentagon. The government lost a smaller battle on Friday over the status of a reported 130 Lebanese and Yemeni immigrants accused of falsifying documents in order to stay in the U.S. A federal judge ruled none of the people can be deported until they've had a court hearing on May 9th. The AP says the White House is tacitly acknowledging North Korea may not be deterred from producing weapons-grade plutonium. President Bush is now focused on trying to keep the North Koreans from exporting the material. Nuclear disarmament activists in the U.S. are alarmed at what appear to be White House moves in Congress to repeal a 1994 ban on developing so-called low-yield nuclear bombs. Last year, the Pentagon gave itself permission to use nuclear weapons against so-called rogue states. The Environmental Protection Agency reports there are 123 chemical sites in the U.S. where a terrorist attack could kill or injure more than 1 million people in the vicinity, and 700 sites where the dead and injured could number 100,000. Elise Campaign with the Natural Resources Defense Council supports a bill by New Jersey Senator John Corzine that would make the industry study the use of less volatile chemicals. But she says the bill has lost steam since the chemical industry lobby focused on a number of key senators.
You could literally follow the money where chemical interests gave $10.3 million in 2001 and 2002. And when the industry was fighting the proposal, they gave at least another $1.3 million in PAC money. The people who went from support of the proposal to then doing an about-face were Senators Spector, Bob Smith, Kip Bond, Voinovich from Ohio, and Crapo from Idaho, and Senator Inhofe.
Senator Inhofe and the White House are now pushing what critics call a weaker bill to protect chemical plants, which leaves out many of the costlier requirements for the industry. The Washington Post reports the gun industry is close to winning federal protection from lawsuits brought by victims of gun crimes. Gun makers and owners groups have donated some $100 million to President Bush and congressional campaigns. Today, the Senate was scheduled to vote on Bush nominee for the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, Deborah Cook. She's opposed by consumer rights and women's groups for what they call right-wing judicial activism. The Democrats' filibuster on Bush nominees Miguel Estrada and Priscilla Owen continues with no end in sight. Behind the scenes, negotiation on the Bush tax cut plan continues. The president favors a $550 billion package that would mostly benefit Americans who make $100,000 or more. The New York Times reports that a smaller package presented by House Republicans would be even more favorable to the wealthiest taxpayers. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
Radio Free Europe reported this morning that Poland announced that a coalition of 10 mostly European nations is preparing to send troops to Iraq as part of a stabilization force by the end of this month. Warsaw said it will share leadership of the force with the United States and Britain. This is 250 delegates representing rival ethnic groups in Iraq's third largest city of Mosul today elected an interim council and a mayor to govern the northern city. While it's unclear just how the delegates themselves were chosen, and some have questioned the democratic nature of these first Iraqi elections, Mosul's chief judge swore in Mayor Albasso, a former army general chosen from a field of three candidates. And across Iraq, the medical situation remains critical, as Aaron Glantz reports from Baghdad.
A crew of workers lays bricks to cover up a hole in the wall of Al Yarmouk Hospital in central Baghdad. On April 7th, an American tank fired into the maternity ward of this hospital, and the medical staff fled. When they returned a week later, the doctors found 26 patients dead in the emergency room, unable to escape the advancing American army. The doctors first buried the dead patients in a mass grave in a lawn on the hospital grounds before cremating them and sending their ashes away. But the U.S. Army's attack marks the least of the worries of the medical staff here. In the days following the American military's victory over Saddam's regime, the entire city fell into a state of lawlessness, and everything was looted, including the hospitals. Most of Al Yarmouk's expensive equipment was taken, as were its air conditioners and its entire stock of medicine. Dr. Walid Hitti is director of the medical department at Yarmouk Hospital. He says only 150 of Al Yarmouk's 1,000 hospital beds are full today. There is no telephone service to call an ambulance, and there are no police on the streets of Baghdad, and so most Iraqis are staying home rather than risking a trip to the hospital.
Still, the people is not able to come to the hospital. The transport system and the they suffer. Part of a human suffering as a war. Part of the war suffering is in inability for the patient to come to the hospital. And they stay suffering in their home.
Today, Al Yarmouk Hospital is guarded by two American tanks and more than a dozen U.S. troops. But even so, the inside of the hospital is not a safe place. Yesterday, a patient was stabbed to death in Al Yarmouk's emergency room. U.S. Staff Sergeant Jaime Phillips.
When they bring people in, it's impossible to control this. They come with like their families and stuff like that. So they brought this guy into the ER, and with three more people that they told the doctors that it was family. So this guy is, as the doctors, is gonna be okay. And as soon as they say he was gonna be okay, they pull a knife and kill him. And by the time we came to the scene, they already run away.
When patients are lucky enough to get to the emergency room, they are met by doctors whose medical supplies were looted. This after more than a decade of tough United Nations sanctions on Iraq. Mohammed is a medical resident at Al Yarmouk's emergency room.
The biggest problem is the drugs. There is no drugs. Equipment's very deficient in equipment. There is no oxygen supply here. Everything is deficient, I think.
No oxygen supply?
No oxygen. Approximately no oxygen. There is two bottles and there is three emergency rooms. If there is three patients need the oxygen, there is no oxygen for them. Yes.
Like most of Baghdad, Al Yarmouk's hospital only has electricity for a few hours a day, and its water is not drinkable. Dr. Mohammed says most of the patients he sees are suffering after drinking contaminated water, and he says many of them die.
the area for contaminated water here. Most of the patients. Here there is no drugs.
Every day, how many people do you see here from contaminated water?
It's full. All the time full. And if you come in the morning, you will see patients dying and others are sleeping on the ground.
None of the doctors have been paid since George Bush launched his war on Iraq. The American Army hasn't paid to reconstruct the health system. Instead, the doctors at Al Yarmouk Hospital have begun to charge the residents of Baghdad directly for their health care in an effort to reach their old salary of $7.50 a month, a wage that had already been crushed because of the sanctions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
As a memorial was held on Sunday to mark the 33rd anniversary of the shootings of four students at Kent State University by the Ohio National Guard, new evidence has surfaced which rekindles old questions about whether the shootings may have been ordered by Ohio's governor at the time and were perhaps part of the FBI's COINTELPRO program aimed at the anti-war movement. Evan Davis was there and has this report.
Here we have, in America, the children of World War II veterans being shot down. When I was drafted in the Army in 1944, they gave me an M1 rifle. That same rifle shot my son. Same type of a weapon.
Sunday marked the 33rd anniversary of the killings of four students at Kent State University in Ohio when National Guardsmen opened fire on an anti-war protest there.
That was only the beginning. When the real story in the history of Kent State unfolds, there are disclosures that will shock the American people, if history will write the truth.
Al Canfora, father of Alan Canfora, who was wounded in the shootings, returns every year on May 4th for an annual memorial gathering.
It's a shame that me at age 77, the parent of one of the students that was shot here at Kent State, is begging for the truth in history. But what do you expect? The first casualty of any war is the truth. And we're still trying to seek the truth at Kent State.
Chick Canfora, Alan's sister, took part in the 1970 protest and was a friend of one of the four students slain.
And we all came out from behind the cars and trees, which shielded us, then began to see those who were not getting up. And that's a horrible memory in my mind, because about 3 feet behind me was Bill Schroeder lying on his back. He had blood all over his neck and his shoulders, and I could tell that he was dead. And then I looked across the parking lot, and I saw some students carrying a girl into the Prentice yard, and Sandy Scheuer, who's a friend of mine, and I didn't even recognize her. I didn't even know it was Sandy until later on that night in the newscast, because she was so gray. She had been shot through the jugular vein. It's a miracle when you look at your watch and time 13 seconds, which is how long they actually emptied their M1 rifles into that unarmed crowd, that only 13 people were hit with bullets. Pretty horrifying moment to be 19 and see American soldiers turning their guns on American people.
Over the years since the shootings, there has been much speculation over whether the Ohio's National Guardsmen who fired on the students were acting under orders from their commanding officer or perhaps from Ohio's then-governor, James Rhodes. An exchange of internal communications between FBI officials recently uncovered by the independent journal The Columbus Free Press revealed an extensive relationship between Rhodes and the FBI, which was engaged in a campaign of so-called counterintelligence against the anti-war movement. One memo from an Ohio officer to then-FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover described Rhodes as being completely controlled by an FBI special agent in charge. According to an article in the May issue of the Columbus Free Press, another memo describes Rhodes this way. He, Rhodes, commented on the riots and unrest which have occurred repeatedly and said some of this might well have been avoided if the director's warnings and advice had been followed. In Ohio, he has not hesitated to use the National Guard to deal with these situations and has instructed the Guard to act quickly and firmly. He feels this is the only way to maintain law and order, and that the maintenance of law and order is the only way our government can survive. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Kent, Ohio.
Today is Cinco de Mayo, an important holiday for many Chicanos and Mexican Americans throughout the southwestern United States. In the 1980s, the alcohol industry initiated Cinco de Mayo promotions, turning this historic event into just another chance to drink. Over the years, celebrations in Californian communities have been increasingly infested with violence, crime, underage drinking, increased DUI citations, and other problems caused in part by heavy alcohol consumption and inappropriate advertising targeted towards Latinos. This Cinco de Mayo, a community organization, hit back. Jovita Juarez is the Southern Chair for Latinos and Latinas for Health Justice. Can you give us some examples of this inappropriate advertising?
Well, the alcohol industry spends about $3 billion a year, or more, probably more, marketing alcohol and tobacco to Latinos, who get a double dose of marketing in both Spanish and English. Research shows that a concentration of alcohol ads depicting Latinas as sexual objects, this leads to increased violence against Latinas between the ages of from like 15 to 18 years old.
And tell us particularly with respect to Cinco de Mayo, so the alcohol and tobacco companies are using this particular day to advertise around?
They choose this day because they know that any holiday, not only Cinco de Mayo, the alcohol industry is pretty smart. They choose the holidays to advertise more because they know that anybody says they'll a better excuse to drink, and why not use Cinco de Mayo? So this is how they get to sell more of their product.
So what does your campaign involve?
What we do is go out into the community, and what some of our goals are to reduce sponsorships, you know, and advertisements that encourage binge drinking, underage drinking, and the heavy consumption of alcohol among the Latinos and other cultures. And we want to get the community to know the awareness of the negative effects alcohol and tobacco advertising has on Latinos and other ethnic communities. And we really need to reduce the alcohol and tobacco-related problems among the Latinos.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the events which are happening today for Cinco de Mayo, where some of these problems that you're talking about with binge drinking might take place?
Well, here in San Diego tonight, there is the Cinco de Mayo at our gas lamp downtown. They don't expect a lot of people. They say they expect about 5,000 because it is a Monday. But still, there are major margarita specials. You know, there's been advertisements throughout the TV stations all weekend long gearing up for this event tonight. They are having taxis for people who do drink and cannot drive, but it's not... To me, it's not advertising responsibly, because still they're saying, come on out. Still, you can drink and drink and drink all you want, shots and tequila, but then you can have a taxi ride home, but then what happens after that? You know, there's still violence, there's rapes, there's things that still go on because of the alcohol advertisement.
And finally, Jovita, for folks who might not be aware what Cinco de Mayo signifies, could you tell us very quickly what the celebration is?
On the 5th of May in 1862, Mexican forces fighting under President Benito Juarez surprised French army forces in the city of Puebla with a, you know, resounding military victory. For the people of the Mexican ancestry in this country, the celebration of Cinco de Mayo has come to symbolize the struggle for sovereignty, self-determination, and the commitment to fight even when the odds seem insurmountable.
And do you think you'll have any luck against these giant tobacco and alcohol corporations?
Yes, we are. As a matter of fact, this is our second year in San Diego, and we have had a lot of luck. A lot of the advertisement has been taken down. They are aware of our campaign. Nationwide, this has our campaign is spreading. The alcohol industry does know what we're doing, and so I do believe that we will have victory.
Jovita Juarez is the Southern Chair for Latinos and Latinas for Health Justice. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Late last week, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, or the LTTE, pulled out of peace talks with the Sri Lankan government. After over a year of ceasefire, the tiny island of Sri Lanka is now poised to return to the civil war it fought for 20 years. Although the LTTE promises the move does not signal a return to war, many say the rebel group is desperate, having lost political leverage and legitimacy within the international community. One of the major issues dogging the LTTE is recruitment of child soldiers. Miranda Kennedy has this report from Sri Lanka.
The Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam bombed their way to the negotiation table, but now they find their political legitimacy seriously challenged by the U.S. government. The U.S., Britain, and India have all declared the LTTE as a foreign terrorist organization, and they accuse the LTTE of lack of democracy and recruitment of child soldiers. Most recently, the LTTE was not invited to Washington, D.C. for a crucial donor conference. They say being shunned by the international community is one of the reasons they have pulled out of the peace talks. Paikiasothi Saravanamuttu is an advisor to the peace talks in Colombo, Sri Lanka's capital.
The LTT certainly has to make a lot of progress with regard to demonstrating that it is a mainstream democratic political party that can operate in a context of pluralism and diversity. Any organization that has been involved in armed struggle is going to face any number of challenges in making that transition.
The LTTE, one of the most brutal guerrilla groups in the world, has been fighting for an independent state in Sri Lanka for 2 decades. Throughout the ceasefire, both the LTTE and the Sri Lankan army continued training soldiers and stockpiling arms. But over the last few months, human rights groups began to condemn the LTTE for using children under the age of 18 in warfare. Over the last year, UNICEF has recorded over 700 complaints of child conscription from parents in Sri Lanka. Jaisarana Raj joined the Tigers when he was 13 years old. Now he is 22. 10 months ago, he deserted and surrendered to the Sri Lankan security forces.
The LTTE requested a lot of money from my parents, but they are very poor, so my mother gave them me instead. They had already given my brother, and he died in battle. I didn't want to go to the LTTE, but now I am a traitor to them, and if I return to society, the LTTE will kill me.
Human rights groups accuse the LTTE of snatching Tamil children forcibly from their homes in the rebel-controlled region in the north of Sri Lanka. The LTTE denies ever recruiting soldiers under the age of 18, but the recent spate of international attention has forced them to make concessions. They recently began a high-profile campaign of returning underage fighters to their parents. In Tiger territory, the LTTE says they take care of thousands of children who lost their parents to the war in orphanages like this one in Kilinochi. According to the LTTE, the orphans are not allowed to join the organization. When asked, all the children here say they do not want to join. But some of them admit that their parents are still alive. Each morning they salute a framed portrait of Prabhakaran, the leader of the LTTE. Father Bernard, a Tamil Catholic priest closely associated with the LTTE, insists that most of the LTTE soldiers under 18 joined of their own accord.
The children would say, in our family, my sister was raped, or somebody in the family had been killed or tortured. And they say, we are a small nation, and I also want to contribute my share to the security of my family. What do you say to that? Many tears have been shed, even by the president, about child recruitment. But what about all the other rights that were being violated of children?
In the north of Sri Lanka, many see the LTTE as the protectors of the minority Tamil people and defend their sometimes fascistic behavior. But it is clear that unless the LTTE makes major reforms, the international community will continue to exert pressure. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Kilinochi, Sri Lanka.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFT in Houston, Texas, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, and Lindsay Benedict. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. Our interns are Susan Chelly and Christopher Martinez. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.